everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And is this an exciting one for me? Oh, my gosh almighty, there are so few fresh, new approaches to dealing with problems, and I have one. I have found something, someone, and I feel gifted. Dr. Martha Beck, who wrote in the very famous book, The Four-Day Win, who, Martha, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, now, and we should know, let people know we're talking from Arizona to New York. And Martha, you have this book of yours, The Four-Day Win, is about diet and weight loss, and is one approach, but it is something that I have found is you can be used in almost any change that you would like to make in your life.
Well, I'm so glad you found that, because it certainly works for me, way beyond weight loss. I just think that weight loss happens to be one of the single most difficult things people can do. So to come up with a methodology for making that really workable meant that it encompassed a whole genre, a whole area of human life. Basically, anything you really, really are trying hard to change that is resistant to change, this method I've found is really powerful for my clients.
And, you know, people are going to find that hard to believe, because everybody always wants to come up with a secret or a trick, and especially in the field of psychology, we have psychoanalysis, we have primal therapy, we have Gestalt therapy, we have bioenergetics, we could take any number of approaches, we could take the biochemical approach,
right.
The latest, we could now do brain science, we could do any number of things, and nothing gets simple. Nothing gets simple, and nothing seems to be what you could do on your own. Let's talk about the four-day win. Let's talk about this, okay? And go ahead. Give it to me as structured as you can from the beginning, Martha.
Well, it is actually based on the new brain science you were just talking about, where people can see the brain at work now in very simple, well, comparatively simple ways, where you can literally wire someone's head up to a desktop computer and get feedback from the brain while it's working. So that was kind of the physiological springboard for this methodology, and then there was other stuff that I just got. I was trained as a sociologist, so when I set out to write about weight loss, I interviewed as many people as I could who had lost huge amounts of weight, like 100 pounds, and kept it off without surgery or anything, and I looked for commonalities in their experience. And then combining that with new research, I kind of came up with the following really quick schematized plan. Basically,
why did weight loss attract you? Because it is something that was measurable?
Mainly because I had so many clients who were losing weight without trying, who were telling me they've been trying to lose weight their whole lives, and suddenly they were losing it, and they didn't even know why. And I thought, well, now this is really interesting. I hope I can package this and try to get it to some people who I think are really, really suffering. The overweight in our culture, they're extremely numerous, and they're extremely unhappy. So it was, to me, I think it's the mother of all psychological issues. Food is so primal, and it's so deeply wired into our brains. And so to change that, ooh, that's a tough case, and I love tough cases.
This is great. I'm sure there's going to be a four-day win about relationships.
I would like to do that, yeah.
I am sure it's going to be coming. Let's stick with this one for the moment.
Right.
Four-day win. How does it work?
Back to the theory. Okay. The basic premise is that the body reacts to fight-or-flight situations with a variety of biochemical and behavioral changes that are very powerful. And if you are in a fight-or-flight mindset, if you're scared of something, one of the things the body does is pack on fat, especially around the middle where it's accessible to the internal organs. And we've just evolved for our bodies to do this. It just is, I mean, my grandmother, two generations back, was starving to death as a shoemaker's daughter in Sweden. You know, it's only been a couple of generations since we were starving as our primary food issue, not obese as our primary food issue. So what I saw people doing was becoming aggressive toward themselves, becoming self-loathing and sort of beating up on themselves in order to make themselves lose weight. as soon as that happens, the brain and the behavioral patterns go into fight or flight behavior, which involves things like binging and gaining weight easily. So there's an amazing study done in the 40s on healthy young men who went on a weight loss diet. Every single young man in this study, none of them had ever worried about their weight. All of them became binge eaters, and they started to show other behavioral abnormalities like depression. One guy got so depressed, he cut off three of his own fingers. I mean, that I would punt him
that's,
to you.
That's pretty serious stuff. Well, we're talking with Dr. Martha Beck. We're talking about the four-day win, and in case, my friends, you're hearing reference to weight loss, but I'm really talking about a structure that Dr. Beck has developed, and this four-day structure is something that I believe can be used for any addictive kind of behaviors or anything you do that you get stuck in. So I love it. So
right.
We're talking about weight loss, but it's not a program about weight loss. Dr. Beck has something to offer.
Right, and what I found out is there are ways that you can bring calm and peace into the brain, but also into your felt experience when you're trying to create a change. This antagonism toward the self, attacking yourself, is a common denominator in all kinds of behaviors that are resistant to change. So I work with heroin addicts, I work with people who have other addictive processes and who are just trying to make something different and haven't been able to in their relationships or whatever. As soon as you start to push against a behavior or a state of being, what happens in the brain, it's called the ironic monitoring process, is that the brain pushes back. And we see this every day. If I ask you, you know, for the next 10 seconds, you can think about anything so long as it has nothing to do with zebras. You know, no African scenarios, no zebra skin chairs. Well, immediately your brain's going to go to thoughts about zebras, preferentially. So the minute you tell your brain or your emotions, don't think this, don't feel this, and even don't do this, you get a kickback reaction from the brain and body, and you end up doing more of whatever it is you're trying to stop.
Well, now, why would that be?
It's pretty simple. It's just like if I told you, go home to your house, and I hate red. Take everything out of your house that's red. Well, the first thing you'd have to do to obey the instruction is go looking for things that are red. So if I tell you, eliminate all red, you have to go looking for red.
Well, if you said, for example, I've got to go exercise, mm-hmm. you know, and you're sitting around lazily and you're not going to exercise.
Right.
Right? So now you're sitting around lazily. You're not thinking about exercise.
Right.
So how does that apply?
Well, the natural resistance that we feel in order to get away from a sense of captivity, of being trapped, kicks in as soon as somebody tells us to do anything, including ourselves.
So it doesn't have to look like it's related to the suggestion. So
no,
if you said, for example, don't watch any more television, you may, you know, it doesn't have to look like the opposite of that which you're trying to control, because the control mechanism can work without the thing becoming visible.
That's true.
The resistance.
True. But the harder you push in an antagonistic way towards something, the more directly you'll get the kickback.
So now, were you saying that this anger at ourselves, this kind of
right. Hatred
at ourselves, is a way of pushing at ourselves as if we are our own enemy?
Exactly, precisely. You couldn't have said it better. And whenever we're faced by an enemy, we get a fight-or-flight response, and we push back. So if I have asked hundreds and hundreds of people, what are the thoughts that you tell yourself when you're trying to lose weight? When you're standing on the scale, when you're looking at your reflection in the dressing room mirror, what are you saying? And they say the most horrible, abusive things. You know, you're such a fat, blankety blank. You can never eat again in your life. And then I say to them, with those thoughts in your mind, with those thoughts active, what do you want to do? And 100% of the people I've talked to have said, eat. You know, when I'm hating myself and pressuring myself not to do it, what I want to do is the very thing that I'm trying to stop. And that's also true with people who make other changes, things like, for example, getting unduly angry at their children. What do you tell yourself? You're a bad mother. You're a bad father. You've got to do better. What do you want to do? I want to scream at people. So whatever you try to, it's Jung said it, what we resist persists. And this is hugely true in the case of addictions. And every weight loss guide out there, every guide to change says, you know, here's what you must do to stop. And it all sort of piles on that negative attack that inevitably creates pushback.
And do you have, didn't you have character names for the attacker? I mean, because one of the things I love is I've seen people following your process, having actual words. What do you call the person who attacks you?
Well, this gets into what I call, in all modesty, the most important weight loss tool in the history of the universe. It's actually a tool. Yeah. I didn't think of it, though. It's actually a tool from Buddhism. I was a Chinese major as an undergraduate in college, so I bring a lot of Asian perspective to my work. And what I have people do is visualize both aspects of themselves, the part that is self-accusatory and self-loathing, and I call that the dictator. It's always like stomping around and smacking its fist in its hand and shaking its gun, you know, it has a whip. And it's always telling you it's going to kill you if you don't do what it says.
How do you picture this dictator? You said you open your palm?
Yeah, I said open your right palm, actually, because...
People listening can do this right now unless they're right. Driving, right? Unless their hands are on a wheel.
Exactly. Hold out your right hand because this activates the left side of your brain, which is where most people do a lot of their dictator behavior. And just imagine a little version of yourself in a military uniform, maybe with a little Hitler mustache, you know, stomping around with a whip and a gun and telling you you're a fat loser.
Oh, my gosh, almighty.
Everybody has it. That's
what a creature. I just saw him. I saw he's right there, sure.
There he is.
Mine's wearing a brown outfit, you know. But he comes from Italy. So, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Okay, so there's the guy.
There he is. And then listeners, if they don't have their hands full, can hold out the left hand, which has the right side of the brain activated, and picture another little 2-inch tall version of yourself. This one I call the wild child, and it's a little kid dressed in, you know, rags and animal skins that doesn't even know how to talk because he or she was raised by wolves. The right side of the brain primarily and the nonverbal part of the self are very identified with this sort of animal-like existence, this animal-like version of the self. And it doesn't know language, and all it knows is if somebody's threatening it, it needs to be safe, and if somebody's going to starve it, it needs food, and it needs comfort, and it just doesn't want to be beaten and yelled at by the dictator anymore. So the dictator says, don't you dare eat, or whatever it is, and the wild child, without words, says, oh yeah, watch me.
So let me picture the wild child again. On my left-hand side, I'm holding up a small Armand who's, like, crazed. It's like from that movie back, what was it, by Truffaut? You know, the wild...
The wild child of Avignon, I think it was.
And there he is, this kind of maniacal, crazy little kid who just cares about surviving, right? He's in a jungle all by himself, or he's in some kind of... is some kind of place where he's all by himself and he's dirty and he's there and nobody tells him what to do because he's just going to rebel and get away and scream away.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Your wild child might look like that, but the wild child that is not beaten by the dictator can actually be a very happy person. But it's a little kid and he's identified with nature, not with social rules. But so if your dictator is very aggressive, then the wild child is going to be, just as you said, a maniacal, angry being. But if the dictator is mellowed out, then the wild child can be quite a happy creature. He just is raised by wolves.
Now, wait a minute. So let's say the wild child is a happy creature.
Can be.
And so let's say you look at your left hand and you see this happy child you, but this is the happy child you who also doesn't listen to anybody.
Oh, yeah. The only way the wild child is happy is if it's being very well treated. In other words, not deprived, never mentally abused, never called names, always, you know, raised as you would raise a beloved child, given comfort and some discipline, but never harshly and never, never judged. We all judge ourselves so horrifically. And that's not the way to...
So it has no room for the dictator. I mean, the dictator can't do anything.
Well, let's finish the exercise, and it's really interesting. What you do as you see both these beings is the next step is to realize they're both very well-meaning. Their nature is essentially good. The dictator is just trying to do what your doctor told you to do and what it says on the news you're supposed to do, and it wants you to be beautiful and healthy. And that's why it screams at you, you've got to lose weight. It's like watching a child run out into traffic. The dictator is screaming because it's terrified and it wants you to be okay. So that's not it, and it's also exhausted from trying to do this thing that never ever works. And so you can sort of soften the feeling of the dictator. Then you go over to the wild child again, and you can see that as the dictator gets tired and falls asleep, the wild child isn't so angry. It relaxes. It starts to feel safe again. And it's just trying to be happy. It has no malice in it either. So now when you're feeling, you know, a little bit less antagonistic toward the two, the next task, this is very, very important, is to offer both of them at the same time, offer them what is known as a Tibetan loving-kindness meditation. So there are three simple phrases that I'd like people to repeat as they look at these two versions of themselves. I like them to say, may you be well, may you be happy, may you be free from suffering, which is not asking a whole lot. May you be free from suffering. Okay, can you
May you be well.
May you be well, may you be happy, may you be free from suffering. And you just offer that to both of them, and...
You're offering that to both the dictator.
And the wild child.
And the wild child. The dictator is another form of wild child. I mean, he can't possibly imagine being nurtured properly.
Absolutely. And they're, what, of course, they're linked. At the deepest level, they're very primally linked. But you can, as the dictator is verbal, and the wild child is pure action.
You think every dictator was once a wild child? Well, that's
this
getting...
This is fabulous talking to you about this. This is great.
Why is it different?
Because I love
think.
The way you think about it.
Right.
You're just such a psychologist. It's fabulous. Yeah, absolutely. At heart, what you'll find is that they are the two aspects of the same being. I mean,
yeah.
Jung would call them the mask and the persona, or, you know... It's the superego and the id, or whatever you want to call it.
But the child part of us, the left-hand side, I'm going to take the wild child. The wild child has not yet become a dictator, but mm-hmm. the dictator has had the experience of the wild child, which is important because if we then nurture the dictator, we have to go through a layer of wild child. It's not just, it doesn't sound like you just nurture the dictator and the dictator says, oh, okay, I'm being nurtured, I'll relax, I won't hurt anybody. It sounds like there's going to be a rebellion there as well.
Well, it's you have to take the leadership role with both of them, and you have to. Here's the challenge. Instead of trying to control either of them, your job is to feel absolute compassion toward both of them before they change at all.
May you be well.
May you be well. May you be happy. May you be free from suffering.
Wow.
And this is the key thing for the brain science and for the... Everything we've seen about the research about how this works, here's the key juncture. If you can look at them and offer them that kind of compassion until you actually feel it, the question I ask then is, who are you? Because you are now neither the wild child nor the dictator, because you're offering them both compassion. So by definition, you can't be completely identified with them. They're outside you. And when I do this exercise with people and I say, who are you? Actually, when I have them do the loving kindness meditation, it is just, it's bizarre. Everybody starts to, you feel a kind of electricity in there. The whole feeling of the interaction with the person changes as they move into this compassionate place. And it actually is an area of the brain, the back of the brain, where the conflict between the two selves seems to take place in the frontal lobes. You go back to the back of the brain, and here's this being that is just compassion. It's not at war. And that shift is absolutely key to changing anything in a positive way.
Hmm. My guest is Dr. Martha Beck, author of The 4-Day Win, bestseller. She's been on so many programs recently because there's something about the 4-day system that is remarkable. It's simple but amazing, and I'm really enjoying doing this. Let's how you wrote the book, though. Now, I guess we want to complete this first, this structure first of the different
right.
characters. Go ahead, you continue with it.
Oh, I just, the other thing I found out, so what I realized was changing the brain and being able to remove ourselves from a fight-flight mental state is absolutely the key to weight loss. And then I noticed something else in my interview research, and that was when people had lost large amounts of weight, this is what they told me over and over again. I had tried to lose weight for years, decades, but this one time, for some reason, I went 4 days without eating as much, and I wasn't dieting. So for 4 days, you know, I had my wisdom teeth out, and for 4 days, I just didn't want to eat much. I fell in love, and for 4 days, all I could think about was the person I was in love with. I went on vacation for 4 days, and I didn't like the food. So the key was, number one, they were not dieting. And number two, they ate less for 4 days. And that number just kept coming up. And that was completely unexpected. But if you look at the number four, our brains are structured so that we see things in patterns of 3 to 5. That's why there are always 3 king's sons and or 3 daughters in the fairy tales, 3, you know, days and nights of whatever until the magic happens. It takes 3 repetitions to create a pattern. And over 5, people start to kind of lose what they're thinking about. It's like, don't give me things in sets of 12, which is why we break phone numbers and credit card numbers into 3 and 4 number clumps. It's called chunking. And what I realized is that if you sustain a pattern for 4 consecutive days, you break through into a stage where that seems normal. And it's actually harder to stop doing it if you can sustain it through those 4 days. So the whole weight loss process or the whole change process, whatever it is you're trying to do, write a book, I don't care what it is. If you can sustain a small goal, a small improvement for 4 days, the pattern of your behavior changes. And if you continue to push that gently 4 days at a time, what you get is a dramatic course change over long periods of time.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned this, Martha, because throughout my life, from 16 years old on, I would always find great benefit in fasting. I liked to fast, not just for weight loss and not even for weight loss, but I liked it.
Wow, and how long would you fast?
Oh, I once went for 21 days.
What?
Yeah, 21 days of fasting. And I've also done juice fasts and all the other things. But fasting once, I would notice, I'd say, okay, all I've got to do is I want to get my head straight. And getting my head clear meant fasting. To me, it was clear. This is the best path in. And I would do it for 3 days. And I would say, you've got to get to that 4th day. You've got to get to the 4th day. And I would say it to myself over and over again. And 1 out of 10 times, I could get to the 4th day.
Wow.
You know, and it was just, and now I'm talking about years before you were probably even born.
I like the way you think. Let's just leave that there and pretend it's true.
So this went on for the longest while. And then I began noticing this thing about repetition of 4 times,
that's
just
so
vaguely.
Interesting.
You know, there's a gymnasium across the from where our office is, the Parker Meridian, which offers the 4-minute exercise. And in their 4-minute exercise, what they have you do is they have you lift weights, but they want everything in repetitions of 4s, only 4s.
That is so
And it has to be 4 seconds to lift something, and then 4 minutes to do another thing. So it's. I think you're saying something is being uncovered here. Now, we haven't discovered anything in neuroscience related to this yet.
This chunking phenomenon. We can remember, the most that people can remember chunks of is about 7, but very few people can do that. If you look, for example, at bullet points on television, they always show at least 3. 2 isn't enough to get a pattern. But if they show 4, people start to feel confused and they don't want to remember all that. So it's sort of implicitly present in a lot of popular culture and just the way we interact, but there hasn't been a lot of research. One fascinating fact that I found is that in cultures where there is no counting, so very what we would call primitive cultures, where they actually don't count anything, there are words for 1, 2, 3, and sometimes 4, and then many. But that that 4 is the cutting point. That's where people seem to be able to perceive clumps of things. And then after that, it just is, okay, more of the same.
So what you're saying, Martha, and I'm going to tell the audience in case they just tuned in, we're speaking with Martha Beck, author of 4-Day Win. Martha, you're saying that anything, if you want to make a change, and you stick to it for a day or two, and then you give it up, that's the problem. Try to go in there for 4 days. Just give yourself a 4-day target.
Right.
And on the fourth day, your head's going to change. Now, I can tell you from fasting point of view, which I don't recommend to people, by the way, but from the fasting point of view, that fourth day was such clarity. I felt such beautiful clarity of mind on my fourth day. And now you said something else. You said it becomes harder to quit than to continue, because once I got there, I didn't want to leave it.
Right.
So it validated itself.
And fasting is something, again, that is so, that takes such an extraordinarily strong person to do that.
And it's tricky. It's tricky who should do it and who shouldn't do it.
Right. But obviously it was right for you. But for most people, I would say do something quite small so that it doesn't require huge amounts of deviation from your ordinary routine. And the smaller it is, and the more regularly you do it, for example, if you do it at the same time each day, on the fourth day, you will find yourself doing it automatically. You will have programmed yourself to do it.
Give me an example of some of the small things that people could do, let's say not related to food.
Okay, the other side of that is exercise, and, you know, we know that that's one of the most powerful things you can do, whether or not you are overweight, to extend your length of life and improve health and all that. So if you are thinking, you know, we get these weekend warriors who are saying, I'm going to go out and run 20 miles on the weekend, and, of course, it never happens. But what I tell people to do is drive over to your gym, park your car, and have a cup of coffee, you know, at Starbucks or something. Pick up Starbucks on the way and have a cup of coffee in the parking lot. Then drive home. You don't even have to get out of your car. On the fourth day, especially since you have the reward of the coffee, you are not going to want to stay home. At that time, you will want to get in the car and drive to your gym. So once that's established, then for the next 4 days, you go into the gym, and then you just turn around and walk out and go home again for 5 days. You break it down into such small components that it feels virtually effortless, and then you sustain that for 4 days. And what I've found with people is that it has a sort of exponential curve of improvement. So they start out with a very small change, but before you know it, they're starting to make pretty radical changes for 4 days, and it still sticks.
Well, let's try that on something else. Imagine somebody who yells, and you were talking about somebody who screams a lot and gets angry.
Right.
Okay, give me an example of a 4-day designed exercise for somebody who's trying to deal with their explosive nature.
Right. I would immediately start with the exercise we just discussed. That, to me, is really a fundamental foundational skill because it changes the brain.
Drive to the gym and drink coffee? That's that the one?
see yourself as the dictator and the wild child, and then offer compassion.
Well, how do you do that when you feel like screaming? When you feel
What you do is say to people, okay, you need a new little component of your routine. Let's say in the morning, get up 5 minutes earlier, 10 minutes earlier than usual, and just sit up cross-legged in bed, or whatever's comfortable for you, and then hold out in your hand the dictator who's saying, don't you dare scream at people, don't you dare lose your temper, you know, you've got to control yourself. Then in the other hand, you have the wild child who's like, I'm going to scream at whoever I want to scream at, and you offer them both compassion, and you, like, just watch them, and then you'll start to think of things, oh, I see why the wild child's so upset, oh, I remember why the dictator, you know, I remember what my mother said that I'm now repeating in my persona as the dictator. You'll start to have insights The most important thing is just to offer that love, unconditional acceptance and love to both sides.
How would you verbalize that? Let's say it was you doing it, controlling mm-hmm. your near violent nature, and you mm-hmm. now have your dictator. What would you say specifically to the dictator? You say, offer it unconditional love.
Same three things that I repeated before. May you be well.
Hi, I'm Ella Joyce. And when
I'm suffering.
So you just say that like a mantra over and over again.
Yeah, you say it over and over and over again, and it has an extraordinarily powerful effect. You know, when they have people, for example, on the negative side of this, when people are forced to speak propaganda, they're more likely to believe it. The actual speaking of words like may you be well, may you be happy, is a very powerful reconditioning force. So saying those things even silently in your head and offering it to both sides of yourself in this struggle to change, that is just more transformative than I can possibly describe.
We're speaking with Dr. Martha Beck, author of 4-Day Win and How to Get the Zebras Out of Your Brain. How am I going to get rid of these zebras, though? They're all over the place here.
I know, they're reproducing now.
Hey, you know, imagine silence for 4 days. That's about Dieter Scheidt. He has 4-day silent retreats.
I would love that.
You know, imagine he gets people together and he says for 4 days, and I don't know where he picked it up because it's just, you know, it's like the 100th monkey.
Right.
You do it over there, and then suddenly they're doing it over in...
Exactly.
You know, where the creek rises. So suddenly he's but he's doing these 4 days retreats, and he says, I do nothing. He says, I have people come here, and they just can't speak for 4 days, and it's transformative.
Yes.
Breaking the speech, trying to talk after you don't speak for 4 days, it's like you want to pick every word, and you want to see how precious every word is. You know, it's like such a fascinating thing after you do it. Now, I'm sure if it were you doing it, you would have people not speak for 2 minutes, you know,
yeah,
and then build it up. You wouldn't do 4 days all at once. You don't speak for 4 hours.
Yeah, or 4 hours and 40 minutes. There's just any multiple of four, as you said, is weirdly powerful.
Well, you know, one of the beautiful things about your book, and I really mean beautiful about the book, is that you do steps. People aren't... I remember when Fritz Perls wrote Gestalt Therapy by...
Mm-hmm.
And in his book, he talked about this book. He said, you know, this book can't be read. It has to be experienced page by page. And he would have people come to the training group with the book, and they would do one page, and they would do all of the exercises and everything about the book, because it's not a book just to be read. As I looked through the 4-Day Win, I realized, I mean, on one level, I could rush through this book and see what you're saying. But your book doesn't do that. It says, stop. You want to make this work for you. Do each chapter, and each chapter is an exercise in itself. Can you describe that, how you structured that?
Well, every chapter has three things. It has theory, it has examples, and it has an exercise. And it is everything that we're trying to change is in behavior. It's not just in the mind. We can change our minds easily by adding new information. But, I kind of follow the Asian philosophical pattern and first thing the Buddha said, supposedly when he attained enlightenment, was, this cannot be taught. So you have to experientially go through the process before any of it really registers in your cells. And weight loss and every other type of behavioral change takes place in the body, in the cells. So when you do the exercise, you have an experience that cannot be taught, but it can be replicated. But we are such a sit-and-learn culture. We are such a verbal culture. And I think that's actually one of the reasons we have out-of-control addictions and obesity and things. We've stopped behaving our way through things, and we think we can do it all in our heads. And that just isn't sufficient.
You know, it's always amazing to me that unfortunately, psychotherapy has kind of fallen into this place where the therapist no longer believes that they are doing therapy in the room. See, if somebody comes in and they're feeling out of control, you could, as a therapist, say to the person, okay, let's gain control right now. Let's work at this right now. That's therapy. As if you were trying to work a broken arm, you know, or you were trying to work your leg after you had an implant or something, you would have to exercise it. And they would say, in this room, therapeutically, practice your wisdom, practice your knowledge, practice what you knew in the room. But therapists don't do that anymore.
Yeah, it's so, and I do think that it's because we have this culture that over glorifies the verbal mind. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that the verbal mind is very fear-based, and it does not typically go to places where we find peace and comfort and all the things that come from beyond the mind. I have a son with Down syndrome. He's 19. And he doesn't have much verbal language, but he is an extraordinarily psychologically healthy person. And I think it's because he's always grounded in the part of himself that is learning without words. And that, I could not agree with you more. Mm. Actually doing things that are not just about reading or hearing words is incredibly crucial in changing behaviors. And when I life coach people, you know, when I train coaches, I say to trainees, okay, you know, Sam coach Becky, and Sam, invariably, they try to pretend that they're in a hypothetical situation and that they're going to use a tool. And I say, no, you're actually going to work on your real life experience. This is not role playing. Everything's real. And that is something that I, again, get from Asian philosophy that I just think our culture is so hungry for.
So when you work, now you talked about life coaching, you come from a family of psychology. Can you just give people a little bit of the background?
It's not so much psychology, it's more academia. And if anything, what you're hearing is my reaction to an overly intellectualized childhood. And my father was a professor, but also a religious apologist, which is a scholarly defender of the faith. Mormonism, and I was raised among seven siblings, all of whom had genius IQs, and really raised to be part of the intelligentsia. And when I had my son, who's mentally retarded, I rethought that entire position and ended up with a concept of life that is based in a part of the consciousness that we don't even have a word for in the West. It is not the mind, nor is it the emotions. They call it the awareness in Asia. And it's the part of you that knows, for example, that the color red is beautiful. That's not really an emotional position. It's definitely not an intellectual position. It is a direct perception of reality.
Hmm.
And so my whole life became about finding grounding in that awareness. And it was really great to have the background of growing up as a faculty brat and then getting all my degrees from Harvard, to push away from that and go to a place that was wordless and yet beautiful. It was a great privilege.
I can hear you have both the background and the other part of you, which is the child saying, you know, I'm not going to follow your path because it doesn't look like it works here. We need something more.
Right.
With your son especially, you needed something much more, and I am sure that your son has been hearing you wish him well over and over and over again, and it must have made a huge difference.
Yeah, I actually found out he had Down syndrome when I was 6 months pregnant, and I had a week where it was legal for me to have to terminate the pregnancy. And I have friends who have done that, and I don't judge them at all, but for me, it was one of those pivotal moments when I had to decide not whether I wanted a baby, but what kind of human being I was willing to associate with, what kind of baby I was willing to have. And because I was given the choice, it just was, again, this incredible privilege of being forced to go down to my basic bedrock beliefs about why a human life is worth living. And I found out, to my great surprise, that the mind had virtually nothing to do with why a human life is worth living.
Mm. What you really made a decision there,
Martha,
if you don't mind, is you made a decision, what kind of human do you choose to be? Not just do you choose to be with, because you chose for yourself? And what choice did you make for yourself at that point?
Well, there were several. The biggest one was, I am not of value because of what I do.
Great.
Or of what I know. I am of value because of what I can experience. So that, you know, the experience of joy. I remember walking around Harvard when I was making the decision, when I still had a few days to make it. And, you know, my doctors, there were five at the University Health Services, and they all said it was like having a tumor, a malignant tumor. I had to have it removed. And I walked around looking at these Harvard professors and thinking, you know, I'm not sure that they look all that happy. Most of them look driven and haunted. Now, I may have been projecting, but I'd been at Harvard for my whole adult life, and it was so competitive and so driven, and I thought, is this what it's all about? Do I want to live my whole life like that and then die? Or is there something else? And I realized that the experience of joy was the fundamental. It's like Emerson wrote, beauty is its own excuse for being. To me, the felt version of beauty is joy, and I decided joy is its own excuse for being and the only reason to bother showing up on the planet at all.
So you decided that you would not be one of these people who get an abortion to forget about the fact that you had a child who was going to have problems and try to wipe it away from your mind for the rest of your life. You decided that you were going to be a being who's going to take what you were dealt and deal with it with love and compassion. You made a choice about your personality, your own self.
Well, definitely I did. But I have to interject there that, you know, I've known people who've made the opposite decision, and it is not a cowardly thing to end the pregnancy. Either with a severe birth defect, it is a tough call. And it can be a very self-empowering and good thing, I think, to say, no, I choose not to. But you're right.
But for Martha Beck.
Yeah, mine was the road less traveled, and I have to tell you, I had no idea how many incredible, beautiful things would unfold because that happened to me. And at the time, I really couldn't see a lot of positive in it, and now I see it as truly one of the most fortunate things that has ever come my way. It is, and I think that's true of anything that appears to be catastrophic. It affords us the opportunity to either lose our lives or get them back. And I got mine back.
And you say that people have an opportunity every day, or actually every 4 days, to get back their lost life in some small way, but in a vitally important way.
Yeah, it's great if you go back to the wild child exercise when I was running around Harvard. Was I there because I was confident I was smart? No. I was there because I was terrified I was stupid. And I've been trying to... The wild child was a little retarded kid who was fighting to be acknowledged as worthy. And so as I went through this process with my son, and I could see, you know, I was already in love with my baby, and I couldn't help but begin applying that to the most disowned and despised part of myself. And I felt this healing begin. And it has gone on ever since. And that's why I didn't set out to be a life coach. I was teaching business school. And the students just kept coming and saying, talk to me outside of class. There's something about the way you see me that's making my life feel better and work better. So it's just, I really encourage anyone who's listening who's going through a tough, difficult time to be still and wait. Give yourself lots of compassion, because you are being given the raw material for something wonderful.
Our guest is Dr. Martha Beck. Martha Beck, the name of the book is The 4-Day Win. Do you ever get by New York at all, Martha, or you just...
I do. I was there a couple days ago. So for about 2 minutes. I did the early show on CBS. I was literally there for 30 seconds, and then I was out. But I'll be back in December, so...
Well, we'll book a time during that time, because I definitely want to meet with you, and we'll talk a little more about this. It's really, really spectacular stuff you're doing. Just one more question about neuroscience. Did it make that much of a difference in forming or in pulling things together for you?
It actually did, because it was so incredibly validating for the observational research that I'd done. And it's, you know, when you and I were both trained, I suspect the iron law was the brain is pretty much fixed by the time you're five, little brief flowering in adolescence, and from then on it's all downhill. And to realize that we're creating new neural connections all the time, and that the brain regenerates itself, and that it changes, and that we can add to it, and that we can keep altering the structure of the brain until we're, you know, until death, that was like being let out of an intellectual cage for me. All of a sudden, it seems there are no rules, there are no boundaries. Oh my gosh, we can do anything with our brains if we decide to. And for me, that was, it gave me permission to believe what I'd seen experientially with the field research. Has it affected you the same way?
Yes, yes, absolutely. We had Norman Doidge, you know who he is, up in Canada.
Oh, yeah.
He was here on the air with us, and we've had a lot of, who is that other, who is the author from the Brain Science Company on the West Coast?
I don't.
Yeah, we had a whole group of them. And yes, it's influenced me. It's especially influenced me with this thing about people as they get older. They think their brain is dead and dying, and how brain science has kind of led you to believe that you can now change anything, no matter what the age. It's such a beautiful thing.
Sorry to interrupt. Did you read the study that this was in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago? They did a study of people who had remained sharp and high functioning until death, and they were going to see why they don't get Alzheimer's, why these people had not developed Alzheimer's. So they autopsied them, analyzed the brains, and found that Alzheimer's showed up in that population as frequently as the rest of the population, but these people showed no dementia because they were constantly regenerating brain tissue by challenging themselves. So biology is no longer destiny in terms of the brain, and that is such good news for all of us. We're getting old.
You know, the guy I was thinking about was Michael Mesenick on the West Coast, who is, and those were nuns, weren't they?
They studied nuns in Canada, and it was fascinating. They could predict how long the nun would live and whether or not she would develop dementia based on the way she wrote sentences early in her life. So they followed, the great thing about nuns is you can follow them for 20 years, they're all in the same place, there aren't as many life variables that are different for nuns as there are for other people. So it was a great population to look at. And what they found is that the nuns who wrote essay questions, responses to essay questions in long, complex sentences when they were in their 30s, lived longer and had far less dementia than the ones who used simple sentences or sentence fragments. So, go figure. The more you use the brain, it's you use it or lose it, apparently.
When you're doing the steps, when you're doing the steps of the 4-day, you know, the 4-day win, mm-hmm. and you're doing it, you have the steps small and then bigger and then bigger and then bigger, being careful not to have the dictator or the wild child dominate the exercise at any given moment by you reminding both the dictator and the wild child that they are loved.
Absolutely.
By the mantra that you say, that says to them over and over again that you are loved, you know, that you may you be happy, may you be loved, may you be free, and this is, and this over and over again becomes part of a way of embracing yourself in a new kind of way.
It's so simple, and it's so revolutionary, it's so powerful. I really, anybody who's listening, try it for 4 days. Try doing that morning meditation every day for 4 days and see how you feel for the rest of the day.
Martha Beck, I look forward to seeing you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's completely my pleasure. You're wonderful fun to talk to. Thank you.
Great. I look forward to it. That was Martha Beck, author of The 4-Day Win. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Be back with you again soon.